Christy's not wearing any pants.
Wow.
Christy's wearing pants.
Excuse me. I couldn't help noticing that strange and interesting plant.
Hello and welcome to The Greaties, the great 80s movie debate, where we see if the movies of the 1980s still hold up today. If you're a child of the 80s, a fan of classic films, or just a movie geek, you've come to the right place. Today we'll be discussing 1986's Little Shop of Horrors, directed by Frank Oz and starring Rick Moranis, Ellen Green, Vincent Gardenia, and Levi Stubbs. My name is Dave, and I am joined by an illustrious panel of 80s experts, including Christy.
Dave.
Christy.
It's your professionalism that I respect.
And Josh.
Dave, it's your respect that I professionalism.
You just lobbed that right back over the net, didn't you?
It's on my Slammed notes, coincidentally.
That's in your notes? You knew she was going to say that?
Christy and I worked this out, so we look good.
Sorry. Oh, good.
You guys are simpatico. This is going to be a long podcast if you guys are in cahoots.
Christy, look up simpatico.
You look up cahoots.
It's usually me and the guest against Christy, Josh. I'm just letting you know.
Christy, you idiot.
That is not true.
That is very true.
That is not true.
I looked up cahoots and it's dirty pictures. I think I misspelled it.
Ooh, goodness. Of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, here on The Greaties, we like to go through the movie that we're analyzing so we can see the history of each panelist with the film. So, Christy, what is your history with Little Shop of Horrors?
I know I've seen it. I couldn't tell you when, but I know I've seen it.
Specifics, please.
I have no specifics.
Who were you dating at the time?
Was he Hawaiian?
Ooh. No, he was not Hawaiian.
Was it during a religious phase?
Possibly.
I knew it.
I know I probably saw it in college in one of the theater oop-de-doos. I don't know. It was always probably on in a green room. So I'd always, you know, see it peripherally, but I don't remember seeing it in its entirety until this week.
Really?
And this was the first time I've actually seen it all at once instead of in big chunks.
Her honesty is what I respect and also what I hate about her right now.
Well, you should be thanking Josh then for you watching
yes,
this.
Thanks, Ooh, Josh.
My favorite.
Well, my history with this movie is long. I saw it in theaters as a 13-year-old nubile boy with my friend that I would drag to all the movies, and this was the last straw for him because we saw a lot of stuff that he didn't like, and this was it because I didn't tell him it was a musical.
Oh.
And as a 13-year-old boy, you know, I've always had a lifelong love of musicals. It's not something that you necessarily brag about as a 13-year-old, how you like to sit around and watch musicals with your mother. But I took him and I was like, yeah, it's Steve Martin and John Candy and Bill Murray. You're going to love it. And as soon as the first song started, he turned to me and he said, you didn't tell me I was going to be singing in this movie.
Oof.
And I knew I was in trouble with him. But I watched this movie a lot. I just watched it a couple months ago. I will never turn down an opportunity to watch this movie. So thank you, Josh.
Thank you for having more respect for this film than Christy over here. I'm mad.
What
I'm
is
aiming
your
pepper spray right at her open eye right now. So if anything displeases me, the trigger's going as soon as I learn how to move it from the safety lock.
She only has one open eye.
Yes. Thank goodness you can't figure it out. I've seen you try to put a round peg in a square hole. So we're fine. I'm safe.
It's very erotic.
It's true.
So, Josh, what's your history with Little Shop of Horrors?
Oh, goodness. The very first time was one of those that's just on TBS with a million commercials, 4 hours long kind of thing. And then I finally got it on VHS, and that's one of those few movies, much like Pee-wee's Playhouse series, that I've gotten in every incarnation, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray.
Laserdisc.
Goodness, I just got Laserdisc last week, so I can go backwards in the times. I got it on DVD-ROM.
Betamax.
Only play. Yes. I have it on Flipbook.
Oh, God.
But beautiful. Just, it's one of those movies where it's hard in this world of movies to figure out your favorite, but when it comes to technical prowess, puppeteering, the music, acting, everything like that, it just lines up to easily be my favorite.
Well, that's good. We're coming at it from different angles, and it sounds like we're all fans, but that's the point of the show, to see if it holds up over the years. Chrissy, I'm surprised you haven't spent more time with this, just because it is Frank Oz and there is, I'd say, a heavy Muppet factor.
Definitely.
Well, then I guess I don't fit in your little box there, Dave.
That's dirty again. What is with her?
Everything is dirty with her.
I took a shower.
That's why we're explicit on iTunes.
Yeah, that's why we're explicit.
So that voiceover is on the beginning, and I did my research and I looked up a lot of stuff. I could not find out who that was. That sounds like a Muppet voice.
It does. It almost sounds like Sam Eagle.
A little bit.
And there's a different one if you listen to the soundtrack version, when, and it must have been before the movie's ending was changed, that it was more of a, on the 23rd day of the month of September, it was like much darker, and it seemed like this other version that we do here, on the 23rd day, it seemed like it was trying to be a little lighter, and right. Hey, audience, don't be afraid of the ending where everyone dies. We'll change it.
Right. Yeah, I definitely feel like I have heard that voice before, but I could not find who it was. But you get
it. Might it have been Frank Oz?
I guess he's not credited ever anywhere. He's in the movie later when Seymour's getting all of the attention for the plant and people are trying to get him to sign contracts and things like that. He's one of the people that's trying to get him to sign a contract.
Some of the puppeteers are up in the subway station in the movie, so a lot of people do have a cameo in it. In fact, Brian Henson is the stem of the plant when the plant's big enough to not be a hand puppet.
Right. It's all great stuff, and I knew this would be right up Christie's alley. And the fact that it's a musical at all, because I know Christie also is a big fan of musicals. I know you said you didn't see this all the way through. Did the music ever like kind of resonate with you before this viewing where you've seen it for the first time?
Oh yeah, I've known the soundtrack for years. I just never got chance. There's something different about being able to listen to a soundtrack while you're, you know, doing other things and having to sit down and watch a movie.
You're the only person I've known to pole dance to Feed Me.
Yes. And it never, ever works. Mm-mm.
You play it backwards, though, and it's got a different message.
Oh, maybe,
it's really cool.
Now I'm picturing her dancing to Feed Me. Thank you. Now on the center stage.
Penny Niggles. It's my stripper name.
She fears change.
it only weighs her down.
But I love the fact that the music is so different. I mean, you've got like a little bit of a reggae number. You've got the Caribbean number. I mean, you have like all the different feels to every song. And I love what you're probably going to talk about next.
The girls?
The chorus.
Yeah, the title track.
Yes.
Yeah, Ashman and Mencken did the music, and then these girls are, I guess you would call, they have names, and they're all named after classic girl, like, 50s pop groups.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care what their names are. They are, would you consider them the narrators? Like, are they there? I guess is my question.
No, they're like the Greek chorus, where they're always commenting and moving the story along, but they're not part of the story.
I think the one time they're seen is Mushnick on Skid Row, which is right before the Skid Row song, when they're dressed sort of as the
themselves,
street people, bums, whatever. Yeah,
right. They're fantastic, and I remember immediately. I don't know when the TV show Martin was on. It was way after this, mid-90s, but I remember when it was on that it was Gina and Pam from Martin as two of these three girls. Yeah, and I used to watch Martin, and I thought it was cool that they were together in this.
Yeah.
You always wonder if it's coincidence. It most likely is, but it's always cool when people come back together, just like any other My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis. It's always neat with acting to see people with such strong characters in one movie do it totally different in another. And that's acting, of course, but it's always intriguing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this title song is one of many standout numbers. Along with the set, I want to ask you guys, like, the set, they filmed it on the James Bond stage in England. Do you think at times the set looks a little bit like Sesame Street?
A little bit. A little like Sesame Street gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Dirty Sesame Street.
Sesame Street with dew in the streets. Yeah. Potholes. None of that smooth studio floor we so loved about Sesame.
But the set is almost like another character in this. And I have either of you ever seen the staged show?
I have not.
Indeed. And that's the first time I realized that there is a different ending.
Okay.
Because that's before the Blu-ray or the DVD that Warner Brothers recalled came out. And that DVD, if you have it with the black and white ending, is worth a fortune.
Okay. So did you see this 1986 version first, or did you see it on stage first?
I saw the original ending first of the movie, and then I saw the stage version just because I loved how different, whether good or bad, the puppeteering is such a challenge on stage. So that's one show, no matter who's doing it, that I'll always go see. But yeah, I saw the movie briefly first, the show snippets on TBS or TNT. I don't know. I wasn't rich, so probably not TNT. Couldn't afford that. But then the stage, definitely. But beautiful. And you're like, oh my goodness, everyone dies at the end? What's going on? Then the truth comes out on Blu-ray.
Because the set is definitely, you can tell that this is a staged show. They could use that set on stage and never really have to change where they are through most of the movie. There's very few sets other than the dentist's office and I guess the radio station that isn't Skid Row.
Exactly. Like when they go into Mushnick's shop, they literally are going into that shop. It wasn't just a false front that they went into. They built actually three different shops or four where they could do the pickup shots of the plant and such. So they had other shops being shot at the same time. Mm-hmm. But you'll notice on the floor of the shop when you actually look at the set, how it's a checkerboard floor. Yeah. And if you really look closely, sometimes there's little gaps in the floor, and that's where they were able to open up the floor where the puppeteers would be like under it. Probably a 10-foot lift on the Mushnick set when the puppeteers were needed under there. It's very cool to see.
Huh. I didn't notice that. That's pretty neat. I'll have to go back and look. And they give you some early, I don't even want to call it, I would just call it foreshadowing of what is going to happen, because Mr. Mushnick is reading a newspaper and the headline is Unexpected Total Eclipse. It's mentioned by John Candy on the radio too, that you're going to get this later where Audrey is coming from. How did they do that in the stage show? Was that song just the exposition of what that Audrey is really an alien?
Yeah, in the stage show, it does open with the three girls singing the little shop opening. And then Mushnick most likely has a prop, if they're smart, that says Total Eclipse of the Sun. But it's more so for the audience to figure out if you're looking at the right spot. I mean, just as any stage show is. But I'm not sure if it's specific to the stage direction in the script that he has that newspaper. But it's just beautifully done in the movie where it spells it out. And then the radio is even sort of in between a different story when you first hear it with John Candy. And then he goes to Total Eclipse of the Sun versus just being an obvious placement. So, I mean, just those little nuances just make it so realistic.
It's great. It's set up perfectly. And Mr. Mushnick is Vincent Gardenia. He's from Philadelphia. I think he's fantastic in this. And I don't know him from too many things, but he is a standout to me in this. He's to me, he's in a rough spot. He is surrounded, and so is Ellen Green, surrounded by all of these what will become comedy legends.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to hold their own. And they not only hold their own, at times I think they're better.
Oh, yeah.
Ellen is so strong. I know they wanted Barbara Streisand at first, and some of the interviews with David Geffen, he wanted that. And I'm sure it would have worked out. We would have loved whoever we got. And now we're familiar with Ellen. And so that just seems like the best, but it really was the best. I mean, I'm sure you guys may have looked up that she was the only person from the original Broadway show that carried into the movie. So you always wonder if it hurts Mushnick's or Seymour's feelings. The original guys are like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, but she's so specialized.
So good.
She's got to have that affect and that look.
Yeah.
And that voice.
Yeah.
I can't get over that voice, like her speaking voice and then her singing voice. She's so funny. She's so talented. I saw one of the other people was Cyndi Lauper, and I like Cyndi Lauper. She could not have done this. No, I don't think anybody could have done this but her, and I don't see anybody else ever filling her shoes. I'm sure that there are lots of talented people out there, but she, to me, is the only one that can do this now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Rebel Wilson is rumored to be in the TV version, as well as the gentleman who was the voice of Olaf in the Frozen movies. I forget his name. But Rebel Wilson, who is funny, I think is on that same page of Cyndi Lauper, where she could pull it off, but you hope it's not a unintentional mockery of it, or not to take it too seriously, of course, but, you know, Audrey made it real and funny at the same time.
Yeah.
Or Ellen did, I should say.
She is Audrey.
She is Audrey.
You can't really divorce the two.
I love it when things like this would happen and it would be a combination of SCTV personnel and Saturday Night Live personnel.
Yes.
And this is a great example of that. What are your thoughts in general, before this, after this, now, of Rick Moranis as he's the lead? Like, I know we can talk about what you think about him as far as this, but where do you stand on Rick Moranis? Because I think he's the kind of guy that, although he's always in funny things, people overlook him, I think.
I think he's amazing with his timing and everything. People forget about the fact that he did sketch comedy for years, not in a movie, not on TV, but he that was his bread and butter. And he adapts. I was partly, when I was watching the whole thing, I was like, oh, I wonder if I'm going to see Lewis, or I wonder if I'm going to see, you know, some of the other characters. No, it
Wayne
is
Szalinski.
Completely different. It is completely its own character. And that really makes me respect his performance even more, because it's not a copy of a copy of a copy, which some guys, you know, some of the performers, it's the same damn character. No matter where they go, that is their stock.
Why are you looking at me with judgment?
Because you're the only one in the room.
Fair enough. There's a dog. Oh, the dog's gone. Never
dog's
mind.
Gone. So what am I going to look at?
What am I going to kick now?
What am I going to kick? That to me makes it even better, the fact that he can not go over the top and be like this new character that he hasn't done before or since.
And that's good that you bring up Louis Tully from Ghostbusters, because that's one of those very similar characters you can easily slip into.
And he doesn't.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids' dad is more independent. He's underdog, but it's still different enough to where you can make a different choice. But mm-hmm. he made this choice, and they didn't even know he could sing when they cast him in the movie. He was cast based on the Ghostbusters success, mm-hmm. which is good that you bring that up. And then thankfully he could carry the note enough for an underdog to sound good against Ellen Green's beautiful belting. It's crazy.
Well, I mean, all you need to do is, he used to sing on SCTV all the time. I'm surprised they didn't do their research and see, because he could actually sing pretty well. I think he even had like a lounge singer character on SCTV.
I think you're right.
One of them. So
what a lucky career. When you think about all the crazy movies, all the awesome sets, he gets to be like the playground actor, in the sense mm-hmm. of not the creepy actor that hangs around at playgrounds.
Yes.
Which, she's looking at me again. But I like my tires.
She needs a mirror for that.
I know.
I have not been on the Jungle Gym for a while.
Just a Jungle Gym's restaurant.
Yes.
The one that's left.
Yeah, you're right about him playing, like, all three of those characters that you both mentioned, Ghostbusters, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and this, they're all nerds. But they're three different nerds.
And they're different kind of nerds. Mm-hmm.
They're different kinds of nerds. He doesn't just do them all as, this is my nerd character. He specifies the type of nerd he's going to be for the, because he's a good nerd, because he kind of looks like a nerd. Mm-hmm. Like he, and things that he would do little, like big bullying little giants. He's the nerd that gets bullied by somebody else, be it Tom Arnold or Ed O'Neill or whomever. He's always picked on or oppressed, and he does do it differently. You're absolutely right.
Spaceballs, trying to be in charge, is in charge, but doesn't do it well, kind of thing. I mean, just another one, just awesome. He's definitely underrated. I don't think people think he's bad, but they don't think he's as good as he is, maybe.
Well, I think it's because he stepped away mm-hmm. for so long, that he's been away and not in the public light for so long, that he kind of just faded.
Yep.
And especially because, I mean, you're in Ghostbusters with, you know, the talent that's in there. I think because they kept working and he stopped, they kind of overshadowed him.
And the fact that he's strong enough to, unfortunately strong enough, for this, I say it out of selfish reason, that he wasn't in the new Ghostbusters and mm-hmm. they offered it to him, but he's taking care of his family now with all of the tragedy that's gone on there with his wife and such. So, I mean, he's happy and doing well, but like Chrissy said, it's easy to be overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the next one you get is Skid Row Downtown is the name of the song, and not Skid Row Sebastian Bach. Skid Row the place.
Get my hopes up.
This, this is a great
life. You got it.
This is a great ensemble song, and I can only imagine what this would be like stage. This is a chance for everybody to get involved and get their moments here and there, and they weave the main cast in with people you'll never see again. It's so well done. I think Frank Oz deserves a lot of credit for this number specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they did at the stage show? It was like just everybody was kind of popping in with a line here and there,
man.
Kind of thing.
It's done so many different ways. When I was in high school, every single part got an actor cast in it. But the way the actual Broadway show is, it's literally Audrey, Mushnick, Seymour, the voice of the plant, who ends up being a bum as a cameo, the dentist, who ends up playing the dentist, a bum, all the salesmen. There's a song called The Meek Shall Inherit the Earth, in which he will be a salesman and then change a quick costume change during the chorus and then come back out. So really, I mean, for an actor, I think the dentist would be the one to play in the show. But Skid Row wise, to answer your question, is usually like 5 or 6 people. It's a very small cast when it's actually done the way it's written.
Okay. So they expand this because they can, mm-hmm. because they have kind of an unlimited space and editing that they can do, and you can't do that on a stage necessarily.
Well, this was off Broadway, wasn't it? It wasn't on Broadway itself. It was like an off Broadway play, which means those houses are tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So any off Broadway play that you go to, it's you're gonna see a lot of experimental casting.
Yeah.
Not only just because there's, you know, they can, but because there's not enough space.
And it's crazy, like the audio, and to give Frank Oz credit, and such as you were earlier, I mean, when a bum walks by the camera in the Skid Row song, you hear their separated audio as though the microphone's on the camera versus just being the choral sound. It's just beautifully put together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Mushnick's is going to close, but Seymour has an idea, and that's where Audrey 2 enters and instantly gains attention. I know Christy's excited by a hilarious cameo by Christopher Guest. Is that
That is not his voice.
Okay. I was going to ask you if that's
that cannot,
his voice. It's obviously
is?
Dubbed.
Yeah.
Josh is like nodding his head that it
I'm
is.
I'm moving the pepper spray to the shoe position right now for naysaying. No, it's crazy. And how great is he? Like, because you think of him Waiting for Guffman, Spinal Tap, anything like that, Princess Bride. And he played it straight at first. He didn't know the style of the movie. So when he came into the shop, he's, you know, couldn't help noticing that strange and interesting plant. Frank Oz is like, bigger, bigger, bigger. And that it's in the commentary, too, how he talks about it. And that's why he's so bug-eyed and exaggerated in it. It's so good. And I believe that's right after they shot Spinal Tap, which is why he was in England at the time.
Oh, okay. Well, that answers that question. Okay.
He plays it perfectly because it's so corny, especially like the expression on his face, the fact that they just brought out this plant and it instantly works and they make $100 off the guy. it's so well done.
Can you break 100?
And then the bums outside the window, like mouthing. There's something that happens where they mouth $50. Oh yeah, that's what it is. They're like $50 outside the window.
Yeah.
It's great.
And then the exposition of how Audrey got there, that she is an alien that he bought for $1.95. And Audrey 2 works, but she's hungry. And Seymour stays to care for her. That's where you get your next song, which is Grow For Me.
I have to say, just to add a little Easter egg for me, in the fact that they're in England and one of the, you know, where it goes from the girls to the three guys that are singing.
Mm. Yeah.
The guy on the very end is Cat from Red Dwarf.
Awesome.
I was like, oh my God, it's Danny John Jules.
That's cool. And that's the one optical. There's two opticals in the movie. The one visual special effect other than just practical is when that beam comes down and the plant is sent.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end for the newly shot ending that most people know is the ending when the plant gets electrocuted. But everything else was in camera.
Mm.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And the puppeteering is where you really start to get into it. I know that Christy really appreciates this, the interaction between Seymour and Audrey too, when he discovers what she really wants, what he really wants. It is he, right? I mean, it's Levi Stubbs' voice.
It is he.
Okay, because
it was confusing because of the name, but then you realize he names it that way because he likes Audrey. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's a boy plan, at least for this. But I'm sure in certain high school or any production, it could go either way.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't think a love affair with the plant and Seymour. I'm not sure as far as emotional.
I think that's the irony too of it, that it has to be a guy because you're calling it Audrey. It's like a boy named Sue or a guy named Josh.
It's a good Bible name.
Good job, Jehoshaphat.
Well, it is very Muppet-like. I mean, even before I did the research and found the stuff that Josh was saying, that it is Brian Henson and other Muppeteers, it's the thing that I'm not an expert by any means, especially with whom I'm talking to about the Muppets, but the thing that they were always able to do is the human or actual mouth-like movements that make the consonants and the nouns and the way they would curl the lips of the Muppet. And that happens unbelievably in this movie.
Oh yeah. Especially it's a little, not easier, but a little easier to understand the bigger he gets, but those small ones, the nuances in those performances, that is
crazy.
That is amazing. When he's just a little tiny one.
Right. And like Josh said, it is all practical. Mm. It's there are not special effects. I mean, there are to a certain extent, but all of it, even when he grows after he gets the first blood, I saw that they shot that by just camera angles. It's not a CGI'd plant by any means. You're seeing what you're seeing, and it's done with, you know, trick photography or whatever you want to call it. But the practical effects in this are unbelievable.
I always thought that plant growing after Grow For Me song was a green screen type thing. And then, I read that it was all forced perspective and the pot moving closer to the camera, or the plant moving closer to the camera while everything else stayed still. It's craziness.
It is. And they were honored with an Oscar nomination as well. Mm-hmm.
Rightfully so. I didn't know who won that year against them. I would love to know that because that's really hard to beat them out.
Yeah. Then you get Skid Row Radio and you get John Candy. And anytime you get John Candy, it's a good thing. Wink Wilkerson's Weird World. His hair alone is a special effect.
Little ants are surfing on it during the scene.
I just
great
love
deputy do.
I just love the nun dummy with the sax.
Yeah, what were they going to do?
I don't know. It's a radio show.
It's a radio show.
And then the plant looks at the lady's butt, who is wearing red, so it kind of looks like meat or blood when he's trying to bite the butt. It's just beautiful. And so, of course, in real life, you know, you got these cables running down Seymour's leg to get that plant to do what it did. And I believe it was partially hand puppet for the stem part.
So somebody had to reach their hand up between.
Right through the old Moranis patch.
Yep.
Is that what they call it in the biz?
Yes,
the Moranis patch.
The Moranis patch, or the Moranis bramble if you're in the South.
And Rick's Moranis. And so that John Candy stuff was all improvised. I mean, they had their bones of the scene they had to get through, but that was all him just messing around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's neat to see, and that's why they put these actors together. It's obviously a cameo for Hollywood and great, but they play so well together, and that's why Steve Martin's in it. And you know, there's so much natural chemistry that can't just be done from a script alone.
Yeah, those guys have been working together for at least 10 years, maybe 15 at that point.
Maybe 16. Mm-hmm. I'm going crazy.
16.
And 4 months.
All right, I regret it. 15.
What are your, especially with the radio stuff and the sound effects and all this, what are we talking here? Just mid-50s, do you think?
No, because they said President Kennedy.
Oh, that's right.
At some point.
That's a really good catch, because it says a decade not too long before our own. You assume somewhere around the 50s, 60s.
But when they said...
Yeah, they did say Kennedy.
Yeah, they said President Kennedy. So that put it right around the 60s. So.
And the following song is Somewhere That's Green.
And love this song.
I could listen to her sing all day.
How good to make... What a talent to make an easily annoying singing voice, beautiful. And even her speaking voice is great and whispery and meek. But you've seen certain plays, or if you ever look it up on YouTube, just live productions, everyone does, you know, great. It's great that it's being done, but it's such a caricature, and it's sort of annoying to hear after a while once you have Ellen Green's voice in your head as the way that it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And what a cool representation of a fantasy world with how exaggerated the sets are, and the trees are fake, and the grass is the Brady Bunch backyard, in essence, that AstroTurf.
You know what I kept thinking? I was like, why? Where else did I hear this song other than the soundtrack, of course? And then I realized it was Family Guy.
Verbatim, shot by shot.
Verbatim, shot for shot with the old guy and Chris.
Look up the split screen online.
Oh, really?
There's a split screen, literally shot by shot.
Oh, man.
It's all good.
And that song is followed by the only song that I feel like I can do without.
Me too.
Some Fun Now.
Yep.
Yeah. Why do you feel that way, Josh? I know that one to me, I'm not going to skip anything in this movie, but if my hand's inching towards the remote control to skip anything, it's this one song.
It's just stylistically, I guess, doesn't have a place. It's hard to piece why I don't. Maybe it's not like, I see how it serves its purpose in the sense of time passing, because now it's Seymour nursing the plant. It's getting bigger and this and that. And maybe that's the only reason they did it. But the movie, it's not in the play. That was added for the movie, for sure. And I think more for a cinematic choice. But it's just, and it's beautiful. I mean, if you ever, I mean, technically speaking, that's the biggest crane shot in the movie, when they end with Audrey out the window and then the crane flies all the way up to the top of the building. I mean, that's really hard to do, especially for back then with how big everything was. So technically speaking, I'm very amused by it. But
I'm amused. It made me happy. It satisfied me.
But yeah, it's musically, I just...
Doesn't quite mesh.
Yeah.
And it is good. It is good for, like you said, the passage of time kind of thing. But just as far as... Maybe it's because they've set the bar so high with those other songs. It's not like it's awful or anything, but it just doesn't compare to the other songs.
That's like my get up and go refill my popcorn or my drink, yeah, or go, you know, kick the dog, as you do.
Absolutely.
I've joked about that twice. I know people are going to think it's true. I only slap dogs.
Well, now at this point, Audrey is huge. And no matter how well they're doing at Mushnick's, there will always be bums laying on the stoop, which is great.
Same thing happens in certain areas here around Florida.
Yep. We call them senators.
Boom.
And then we're treated to one of the greatest 2+ minutes in movie history. With Dentist.
Ugh. Beautiful.
One of the few times you see Steve Martin with black hair.
Indeed.
Even though it's not his.
My Blue Heaven was the other one who had shorter hair, yeah, but still everything else is
Normal white hair. Even The Jerk is a little, he's still got a little bit of gray, but...
Yeah, he looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
But he's actually quite handsome when he has darker hair.
Yeah, and you don't know, as a kid, I didn't even put it together as Steve Martin.
Right. And Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, he is like black pennies from heaven. He has dark hair.
Yeah.
Because it's dyed. But he looks so crazy because you never see him like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is so fantastic. The singing, the choreography, which a lot of it was his ideas, the lyrics, it's complete perfection to me. I read online that it took him 6 weeks to film his scenes, and he's really not in it that long, which to me means he really wanted to get this right.
Oh, definitely.
And all the intricacies of the Dentist song, with the guy, the mannequin falling from the ceiling when the guy's trying to hide from him, or another beautiful puppet that most don't think is a puppet. I just thought it was maybe a camera in a mouth, but it's that shot where it's the...
Oh, he's reaching in the mouth.
Yeah, and yeah, he's got a forced perspective scalpel that's, when you really look close, it's tiny in his hand and gets really big. It's actually like 2 or 3 feet long, they said in the commentary, to make it have that perspective. But that's just another beautiful example of a puppet mouth that articulates with the tongue doing what a tongue would do when it says, you know, the certain words. It's craziness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so well done. And the things that he added to the choreography, like the attacks on the dental hygienist and the twisting off of the doll's head, these were things that he stuck in there. And the kind of things you remember about it.
And that's Jim Henson's daughter.
Oh, it is.
Oh, kid.
Really? I'm sorry. It's the one that has the braces on that Bill Murray's like, well, consider yourself lucky. The one with the big mouthpiece on that comes out later. That's his daughter.
That's awesome. She's funny.
She's good. Yeah, it doesn't look like a favor cameo. It looks like, oh, cool, a cameo if you know it. But she totally sold it like anyone else could have.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
No, she's no pun intended. She's got chops. Like she... She really, like, I always laugh at that girl because of her describing without speaking what has happened to her, and he understands everything.
Consider mm-hmm. yourself lucky, which is also an added character, that sadist masochist mixed with the dentist and Bill Murray, because that's not in the play.
Well.
Just an added funny thing because they could get Bill Murray.
Yep.
And it's totally worth it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? I almost think of Steve Martin's role, and we did our top five off of Steve Martin because in my mind, he was a bigger part of this movie. But for me, Steve Martin in Little Shop is kind of like for me and Meatloaf in Rocky Horror.
Where you think it's such a bigger role.
You think it's a bigger, you remember that character so strikingly, but they're in a little chunk of the film.
Mm-hmm. You always put him together with it. Yeah. Yeah. Then you realize, nope. Now
really
he's a fake
not.
Leg and a plant's eating him.
Yep. That's a good comparison, the Meatloaf thing. And he is doing Elvis, right? Or
I would think he's like an abusive Elvis.
Yeah.
Like Elvis look in the new years, but Elvis acting in the later years.
Because for no reason, he has a Southern accent. And the thing that later we'll talk about the Bill Murray scene then, but when he's pumping up the Bill Murray chair, he's doing the Elvis kind of swivel to the pumping.
He's got some Elvis Zuko quality to him for sure.
And Seymour and Orin Scavello DDS meet shortly after that. It's another hilarious scene anytime you get these guys together. Then Audrey 2 talks, and I think this is where, like we said, the puppetry at this point is legendary. You can't take your eyes off it, coupled with Levi Stubbs' voice. Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops. And the song Feed Me is the next song. I saw that Eddie Murphy was considered, and I love Eddie Murphy. I think he's insanely talented, and I'm a big fan. I don't think Eddie Murphy could do this. This Levi Stubbs, that's why I put him on the, like I said, like, you know, the movie we're talking about and who stars in it. I didn't say all those other guys because they're listed as, I don't know, guest stars or
guest
special appearances or something.
Special thanks to
Christopher Guest Appearances.
All right. Levi Stubbs is one. We talked about, we did our voice performer lists not that long ago with James when we did Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I can't believe that I forgot about this. This is an insane voice performance. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
And it's great that, of course, you know him from the Four Tops, and if people are a huge fan, they hear that voice and, oh, that's a guy from the Four Tops. But most people would watch it, especially because the Four Tops were sort of out of their heyday by then.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was Eddie Murphy, like you said, he's talented, but you're like, oh, cool, that's Eddie Murphy, like when you watch Shrek.
Yeah.
That's the plan. And so it's weird when you hear Four Tops music to this day. I have like a Beach Boys channel on Pandora as one of our new sponsors that I now mentioned.
No sponsors?
No? Oh, fair enough. No, okay. On a paid subscription. And you hear Levi stop singing normal songs. You're like, oh, the plant's in a good mood today. That's great. It's great.
Yeah, I think Eddie Murphy would have stolen focus from this, whereas Levi Stubbs is perfect for the role.
It's wonderful. And I'm assuming it was all pre-recorded. No, it had to be so the puppeteers could get the choreography down. But I always wondered if they were able to improvise anything on set. But that was probably recorded later if they needed it.
Now, my question, when they do the live show, is the performer the one that's doing the puppeteering?
No. So the guy backstage is, or girl, whoever the voice is, doing the voice. And then you got the puppeteer, which means when they do the stage show, you have to get someone you trust that's going to do the same syllabic pentameter each time.
Wow. That takes a lot of rehearsal.
Yeah, and you'll notice when the bigger the plant gets on the stage show, it's a harder puppet to lift because usually it's someone crouching in the bottom of the mouth, lifting the top of the mouth. And so the plant talks much more, feed me, like more syllabically to where it's separated, whereas this one, they just go nuts and regular, you know, pace to the talking.
Because they had time.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And this duet is great between Seymour and Audrey. I might ask you your opinion as well. I think it's Moranis' best singing in the movie. And I think he deserves huge props for having to act opposite the puppet. I think he sings well. I think his duets are his best singing, whether it's him and her or him and the plant.
And it totally calls out how good he is at the emotion of the singing, which is an actor's job. And a lot of people just sing and then get the job done. But he sounds, to your point, that he sounds better in this. You know, in Skid Row, he's meek and feeling down. And then this one, you know, he sees Audrey get slapped by the dentist and gets, mad, which is a beautiful shot in the window. They shoot him through the window with a red neon light shining on him, representing his fury. But when he has to put in the drama to the acting with his singing, it totally works.
Yeah.
It's not just someone singing and going through the motions. And that plant just equally matches up to him. And it's nuts. You may have this that you may have wanted to mention later, but they had to shoot all of that in half speed, either 24 frames or 16 frames a second. So anytime the plant would talk, Seymour, anything you see with him in the shot, he had to be walking in half speed, slow motion. So it'd be like, feed me. That way they had time to articulate the mouth, then they speed it back up. So if you really pay attention to Seymour in that, any of them really, any of the songs from here forward in the movie, it sort of looks a little fast forwardy, and that's just because he had to do everything slow motion. And that's the only way they can get the articulation, the timing down with, you know, upper lip, lower lip, tongue, everything.
That is cool to know. I didn't even think about that.
I had read that too, and I never noticed that. I never, like, that to me means these people were even that better, that much better than you thought they were, because I didn't know that for a fact that's what was happening. It never looks to me like they're sped up or moving slow or anything.
It's only when you know that you sort of see it, but yeah, it never jumped out at me either.
Well, he's convinced that Oren can die because of his treatment of Audrey. How evil is Steve Martin in this movie? I mean, you want him to die, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
He calls her a slut. That scene where they return from their date, although it's not really a date because they're gone for just a few minutes.
It was the shortest date ever.
Well, she fell off the motorcycle, ruined the night.
Yeah. He, in I guess there's a take where you can see this. He, in one scene, thrusts open the doors and breaks the glass and cuts his hands. Steve Martin cut his hands on the glass.
Really?
So in the movie, at least the version I saw, he kicks the door open because he had cut his hands on the door.
Yeah, and that's in the bloopers. It's actually on video because it's one of those things you would read and you're like, oh, okay, cool. It sounds like an on-set story. And it's in the outtakes that's actually on the Blu-ray.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you see him hit his hand. You don't see him go, I caught myself, but his hands kind of shudder. And that's why in the next one, you'll notice the doors kind of stop a little more systematically and don't fly back in his traffic pattern. Yeah. But he's such a good job of making the character enjoyable and comedic, but you're not sad that he dies, other than the selfishness as an audience member that you love Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. But character-wise, I mean, that he's so mean to Audrey. And the fact that they show it through shadow in the window is such a good way to be graphic without overdoing it with the whole slapping.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then you get Bill Murray right after that. It's the only time they've ever been together in a movie. Two legends, old friends, This is, I can't believe this is the only time this has ever happened, I guess.
Crazy.
Because I remember I used to show, even when he was too little to probably be watching it, I used to show, one of my favorite sketches is, it's the dumbest thing ever, but I always laugh. It's Steve Martin and Bill Murray on Saturday Night Live walking out, staring at the camera and just saying, what the hell is that? Over and over again.
I think I've seen that. It sounds familiar. I'd have to look that up again. That sounds also different readings on the what the hell is that line.
It's yeah, it's just them looking just past the camera, and Bill Murray's actually doing his Carl Caddyshack. This is like before Caddyshack. He has the lip, he's got the whole voice, and it's just Steve Martin going, "What the hell is that?" And then Bill Murray going, "Excuse me, but do you know what the hell that is?" And then Steve Martin goes, "Oh, I know what it is. But what the hell is that?" Over and over again. That's the whole sketch. It is brilliant. Brilliant. And later he does say, I'm almost wondering if it's on purpose. When Steve Martin is later attacked, I don't even know what you want to call it, with the gun by Seymour, and he's got the gas on and he's laughing, he actually says to the gun, "What the hell is that?"
A gun.
A gun. In that voice.
Oh, that's great.
Now, I read too, and I'm sure Josh, you saw this too, that the dentist's office was supposed to be bloody. There was supposed to be blood everywhere. It was supposed to be really like a shop of horrors, blood on the walls. And audience didn't like it, so they had to go back and paint it over white and redo the scenes.
Mm. Yeah, there's so much that they depended on the audience test-wise for this, when it should have just been, here's the source material, we're making it a movie before a reason, but when things test, they must have really actually disliked it versus, because you always worry when these testers, when people stop laughing, it's the whole theme park show mistake too. If they're not laughing, they're not entertained, and that's just not the case. I say that because I'm not funny.
He's not really.
Okay, I was hoping you're funny, but thank
you. Oh,
I
know you're funny. Sorry, funny. Josh, I didn't realize this was all about you moment. Okay.
Sorry, the dentist is wearing off of me. But it's that whole mistake where if they're not cheering and clapping, they must hate it. But I'm sure back then they had to fill out some questionnaire and say, well, I don't like the ending. But they didn't change the Titanic ending. Too bad.
Yeah, right.
Little Shop's not based on a true story, though, is it?
Yeah, it is.
I have to
strange.
Check on that.
Yeah.
They put so much weight on what these people said, and we're going to talk about the ending a lot when we get there too. But it seems like Frank Oz was not happy about this, that he had to change so many things. Why was the studio? Why did they care so much what a few test audiences said? Because it's called Little Shop of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I think what was it up against
in 86?
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I don't know. Maybe, I mean, were there television people being the executives? Because that's usually a television move.
It was up against the finale of Dallas.
Yes.
Well, I wonder if they like showed it just like a bunch of old ladies and they were offended by it and they changed their movie. I want to know who was, you mentioned
Rocky
Horror.
Who was
this
test audience?
Yeah, like you mentioned Rocky Horror. If you showed Rocky Horror to people and they were like, oh, it's a little too risque for me, would they have changed it all?
Well, okay,
I don't know.
Yeah.
This test audience thing is kind of baffling.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it existed beforehand, but it's one of the first cases of oversensitivity in older cinema that I remember. Mm-hmm. That today would totally be it. I mean, the status quo is oversensitivity and people just getting offended over the dumbest things versus things that actually matter in the world. But it's crazy. It must have been so much money in this that they were just so scared it would lose money, but what a great ending it is for anyone who actually does get to watch it, and what an expensive, intricate ending it is.
Oh, yeah, and to end it so differently, just, I it's kind of disappointing at the fact that they actually let these people dictate how the movie was going to end when it's a play. And you can probably guess that people that watched the movie that probably were like, oh, I love this movie, I'm going to go see the show. Like, kind of like you did, but really realizing how different of a turn it took.
Yeah. And it's not just the psychology of like, oh, it's the ending I'm used to and now I hate this one. It's like both endings on their own are fine. It's the reason you change it.
Yeah.
But test audiences have deciphered many other changes in movies, I'm sure, but this is one of those huge ones where it was like months and months later that they had to go reshoot this crazy intricate ending. And what a treat for the people who worked on the ending. I know we're getting ahead here, but the people who worked on the ending to get it finally on Blu-ray and beautiful and not just a black and white kind of crusty version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. Did the stuff in the dentist's office make you squirm? Because it's the drilling
and
the
bit,
way...
Yeah. It did.
Bill Murray is pulling him in and almost like orgasming to this.
And that sound effect of the drill on the teeth. Yeah, that's the one part.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, it's like anybody that's anti-dentist is not happy at this point. And I love that Murray knows how all the equipment works. He's setting it up as soon as he sits down. And much of his performance was ad-libbed as well, which is great credit to Oz and the writers that they let these guys just do their thing.
Mm-hmm. Oz is such a good director. I mean, some people may, of course, know him from Muppets and Yoda and Miss Piggy and everything else, but what a good director on the other end, too, especially for someone who has a cinematic mind and can really wrangle this whole puppeteering challenge that Little Shop is.
Is that picture of the neglected mouth a monkey? What is that?
I always thought it was a dog. It always looks like a dog whose lips are being pulled up and down.
Okay. I don't know what it is. It's hilarious.
Especially on my old TV as a kid, I was like, what is that? And now on Blu-ray, it's, what is that?
what the hell is that?
Do you think Seymour would have shot him?
No.
I guess it depends. Maybe if he's rushing at Seymour and it was more of a reflex flinchy type thing, but to do it in a brave way as he intended, I don't think it would have happened.
Yeah. I mean, he lets him die, which is sort of like killing him, but it's not what his intentions were. And he does chop him up.
True.
It's only real blood in the movie.
Yeah. And really not that much.
No.
Little on the newspaper to imply.
And after that is Suddenly Seymour. One of the greatest duets ever.
And you can tell they're really singing. You can look at their necks and see that they're belting it.
Certain parts you see breath coming out because the soundstage was so cold.
Yeah.
And they had to put ice cubes in their mouth at certain points, from what rumor says, just to get the mouth cold enough to where you didn't see breath everywhere, like in the shop. But in easily, for my taste, like duets, like that kind of thing, easily sometimes I get bored. Mm-hmm. And that's just great. It's still awesome and hold your attention.
Yeah. Ugh. That's one of the best. Every time that song comes on, I have to blast it. Just turn it all
with your bass and your Honda in the driveway.
To 11. I have to take it to 11.
It goes to 11.
And Mr. Mushnick confronts him after that with Supper Time, the song, and Seymour allows him to die.
Yes.
How are you feeling about Seymour at this point?
Seymour is making a choice.
He's in too deep. He wants that lady.
Yep.
And if Mushnick falls in the mouth, that's less guilt than Seymour pushing him in. Just give him some gardening tips until he backs up far enough. Yep. That's my motto on life.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting character arc. Like, he's definitely supposed to be your hero, but at this point, he is making choices, like you said, that make him not very heroic.
Mm-mm.
He's in too deep. I mean, the plant's getting too big, of course, and I think now it's finally when he realizes that the blood from the finger diabetes check isn't going to do the job anymore. And
now he's already gotten a taste of human flesh.
Oof. And some good old high boots.
Yeah.
And dentist scrubs, which is very addicting.
Tastes like fluoride. That's why his teeth are so white.
Got some good looking teeth, that plant.
Oh God, the molars on that thing.
And a mouthful of KY, from what they said. They had to put lubricant all in his mouth for that salivary
shiny
look.
Oh,
so anyone who got eaten probably had a nice shiny sheen to them afterwards.
And the other song you were talking about, Meek, Shell, and Harriet, is another kind of montage song. But Seymour and Audrey decide that they're going to leave. And Audrey 2 has taken over the entire store at this point. And this is where you start to get into the differences in the ending. Because in both of them, it starts with him calling Audrey to lure her over to the store.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point on is where there's even YouTube videos where you can see split screen of like the original ending versus what the theatrical version was. And I honestly didn't even know that there was the original ending available to see until we started talking about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know when they were talking about the re-release, they had said what the excitement about the fact that they were finally going to release it with the original ending. And Frank Oz was so excited that people were actually going to see it in theaters. And
he did a commentary for it, came back for it, didn't just sign his name to it. He cared about it. Going backwards just a little bit on the side note, technically speaking, that plant that sings Supper Time, you only see him singing for a moment, and then the rest is sort of underlying bed of music while Seymour and Mushnick are arguing. Rather than building a bigger plant, because that's now the next size plant, they used the same plant that was the previous size that talked, but built the shop, just the corner of the shop you see him singing at, smaller. So that's the same size plant, just with the shop smaller to make the plant seem bigger, so they didn't have to make another puppet that could articulate crazy.
Wow.
And then the plant is bigger after Mushnick, which then articulates. So they kind of skip an articulated plant and just have a plant for looks, the one that eats Mushnick.
Yeah, all this stuff is, I mean, the technical things that were going on, these people were geniuses. Because none of this, you don't notice any of this. I mean, you notice it if you really want to and you do the research like we have. I've seen this movie 40 times, 50 times in my life, and I never knew any of this stuff until we started doing this. Yeah, it's so good.
Until you know, you don't know, and it's great.
What I'm going to do, if this is okay with you guys, I'm going to go through the rest of the theatrical release, and then we'll go back and talk about the differences.
Okay.
I'm fine with it, but Chrissy's rolling her eyes over here, so.
I don't have it in my notes.
I'm just kidding.
I'm
she's
not
fine.
Surprised that she's rolling her eyes.
You hush.
Very difficult to deal with.
I hate
it. Audrey 2 goes over, and Seymour then will come and rescue her. She's in the mouth. And at that point, he will pull her out of the mouth. And this is what Josh was saying. This is where you get a total break. So in the theatrical version, there's a reprise of Suddenly Seymour that is interrupted by Jim Belushi, who actually, I think this is great. And because this doesn't happen, I don't think, in the original ending, Jim Belushi actually acknowledges that they are singing.
Right. If you two kids would just stop singing for a moment.
That is a riot, because they never do that in musicals.
Nope.
And he calls it out.
Which means everyone in Skid Row knows they're singing.
Exactly.
People are like, shut up with the Suddenly Seymour. Shut the hell up.
I love it. But at that point, Audrey is alive. Seymour has rescued her. And Seymour decides that because the Jim Belushi character does want to mass produce and sell Audrey 2s, make it into a fad, almost like the hula hoop, that he must destroy Audrey 2. And then you get the Oscar-nominated song, Mean Green Mother from Outer Space, which is the first Oscar-nominated song with profanity in it.
Yep.
Written for the movie, Audrey 2 pulls down the shop and Seymour electrocutes her with an exposed wire. We've kind of talked about that already. But that's not how this movie was supposed to end, and it's not how the stage show end like we've been talking about. Josh, you know way more about this than I do, because I'm just learning this. So like at the point, and I was trying to describe this to my son, I'm insanely creeped out by the ending, especially with the Audrey stuff. She goes outside. He does rescue her from the plant, but she goes outside and she is going to die from the injuries sustained in the plant. Am I right?
Indeed. So you'll see the edit happen. He's like, Audrey, are you okay? She's like, yes, no, and falls. And then there's an insert of Seymour going, Audrey, Audrey. Then we go to the new ending right after that. And the original ending, with the plant taking over, she falls to the ground and then sings a reprise of Somewhere That's Green, basically saying, you know, feed me to the plant, that way I'll always be a part of you. And it's so sad and good. And in the stage show, it was a little more comedic. So she would go, when I die, and then she would take to the audience, which should be very shortly, and they would get a laugh. But it's played so real in this, and I'm so glad that Frank Oz thought of it that way.
Okay.
Because, you know, Ellen Green could have easily come in and done it the way it got a reaction for theater, but maybe it was her that was astute enough to do it just real. But yeah, it's not an obvious edit if you don't know, once again, just with any of these trivia tidbits, but you definitely see, like, okay, that's Rick Moranis 3 months later. He got a haircut. It kind of matches.
And I never noticed, ever, once.
Yeah, especially because no one knows that the other ending, I mean, was shot. And when you get to that other ending, I mean, those models that were used for all the high-speed photography, on a side note, that's the same model that's the green screen behind Steve Martin during the initial Dentist song when he's on that motorcycle intro. Oh. It's like, why, may as well use a model.
So she's hurt so badly that she wants to die. She knows she's going to die. She wants to be fed to the plant. And that's correct?
Indeed. I mean, I don't think she wants to die, but I think if she is going to die, she wants to contribute to see more success with the plant.
Yeah, like, she wants him to keep going.
Yeah, because she knows that that's when he admits it, or that the plant said that, you know, that he ate the dentist and Mushnick, and that's what made the plant so big and Seymour so famous. And Seymour's apologizing, of course, and then she's like, but I want you to feed me to it. So it's far-fetched, which could be comedic in that just situational sense, but once again, played so real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's a very supportive girlfriend.
Indeed. No girlfriend ever let me feed them to a plant before.
Seriously. No.
And it's so dark, the way it's shot. He slowly carries her dead body to the plant. You see them from the sides while the mouth is slowly opening, and he gently places her dead body in, and her hand is sticking out of the mouth. He's holding her hand while the mouth closes around her.
Ceremoniously, the plant, almost with respect, doesn't do the whole quick chomp down, chew up like they did with Mushnick and Dentist. And just that shot of the double doors opening and the plants there with the vines sort of writhing, almost like evil villain hands ready to take her. It's so good. And the fact that he can't bear himself to touch her hand one more time, he almost touches it and then it just slips into the mouth.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets darker for sure. He goes up to the roof to commit suicide. And then the Jim Belushi character, now by Paul Dooley, who was also in Waiting for Guffman as the person who's was abducted by aliens that went in my buttocks. He wasn't available for the reshoot, which is why they got Jim Belushi. But yeah, that's the same gist on the roof now, where he's got these little plants that they're going to mass produce. And that's
took a cutting.
Scary.
A cutting,
the Liberty.
I don't need you. Vegetables are public domain.
Paul Dooley's great. He's so Larry good. David's father-in-law on Curb Enthusiasm. He's good. He's so funny. And I'm watching this for the first time. And now you're kind of put off by it. I'm not saying I'm one of these snowflake audiences that would have changed the movie. But after seeing one thing for most of your life, when you see something different, it's kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Big time.
And now he is going to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
But this conversation with Paul Dooley convinces him that he still must destroy the plant. The song's the same. He still pulls down the ceiling, but instead of anything that happens in the theatrical release happening, he grabs Seymour and slowly puts him in his mouth and spits out his glasses as he kills him as well.
And what great editing, because all they had to do was cut out the hand coming out with the electrical cord and then now replace it with him getting grabbed. And what a beautiful wide shot that is when Seymour is being picked up and carried into the plant. You got the wind on his hair because of all the other plants singing and the breath of the plant, the big plant. So cool.
And I guess I never thought, like, you never see when the hand comes out and grabs the electrical cord in the theatrical release, you never see a face. It's just a hand. That's probably not even Rick Moranis, is it?
Probably not.
That's a good point. Yeah. I wonder if they cut to him watching it. I'd have to see it again because now it's so hard. I just love watching the other ending whenever my lady and I watched the movie, and she would have loved to have been here tonight because she's a huge fan of it too. But yeah, I always wonder. I mean, you figured they had him there maybe, but then again, they had to lay him under that rubble and they were shooting other stuff. Might as well use someone else's arm if they could.
Yeah. Try to shoot as much as they probably were on such a tight turnaround.
Yeah.
They had to quick use somebody as a stand-in.
I would love to go to that soundstage 007 where they shot it and just know how much history is in that place.
Yeah. And it ends also kind of strangely with something else that doesn't really happen. Those girls, the Greek, what did you call them? The Greek,
Greek chorus.
They're always on the street. The next shot after that is this very strange shot of them singing in front of the American flag.
Mm-hmm.
And the song Don't Feed the Plants, which is how the musical really ends. And everyone in America buying little Audreys like Paul Dooley / Jim Belushi wanted to go all over the country, in which they will take over the country.
Mm-hmm.
What a good observation on the fad that, you know, the Tickle Me Elmo, Cabbage Patch, mm-hmm. anything like that, how people are going to go crazy for it. Yeah. Turbo Man, Jingle All the Way. I mean, it's all...
it's turbo time.
Booger is terrific from Revenge of the Nerds in that, by the way.
He is.
It's got a little cameo. But yeah, it's scary because you're like, this could really happen. And then the whole special bulletin interruption when they're watching Carson about the plants taking over.
And then it comes through the screen.
Oh, so good. And that's so cool seeing the plant in a different environment, because that's where you see the news camera running towards it and it's shaky, like handheld, and you see the puppet off in the distance on the set, and you've always just seen it static in the Mushnick shop. So that was one of the biggest things I was excited for when I saw the ending. Just seeing the plant in a different environment, yeah. Show the scale of how crazy and big it is.
It becomes the whole town is under attack. The plants take over New York, and then these other towns. They mention even towns like the, some of the lyrics are like towns like Peoria and things like that.
Eat Cleveland.
It becomes very Godzilla, and the ending is very long. I mean, this is like a 20-minute ending.
And it makes me wonder if the ending was that long, or when they re-edited it to put it out on Blu-ray, if they just wanted to give everyone's hard work screen time. Because it sort of sounds like the music, it's well edited, but it sounds like it loops a little bit on the ding, ding, ding. It works still, but I always wonder if it was that long theatrically. But everything they show, I mean, has a reason to be shown. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to cut out any of that stuff either. The plant, the train going in the plant's mouth, and the mouthing of the very harsh cuss word for Little Shop by the National Guard at the end. He's like, what the fuck? It's just crazy. It's so good. And the model work is terrific in that. That's another case of high-speed photography, just like the movie Earthquake or anything like that. You know, in real life, it's all just crumbling fast and shoot it fast, and it looks big and has mass to it. But that is a long ending, and I always wondered that, too, if it was
that way in the movie. The thing that I found was a little odd is that, you know, when those big pieces of building are coming down on people, they almost look like, you know, when they used to... In the thought of like when you blow up a large beast and it's got the skin on one side and the pink and the red on the inside, like big pieces of meat. That's what the building pieces look like.
Building's a beast. Like, so you always wonder if it's that styrofoam or is it just something they really show? Because when some of the models break apart, they really break apart as separate bricks, which is cool. But then the big parts that are hitting people.
Yeah. And like the big, definitely, I mean, they're definitely foam. But these boulders come down and it just is so weird because there's like a skin to it and then it looks like it's red on the inside. I was like, it just looked
maybe the older
strange.
Film didn't show those anomalies. Or maybe it's more shadowed back then.
Yeah.
But they did a good job environmentally with things hitting, like the one red car and the roof kind of caves in a little bit when the foam hits it. And they show that car beforehand, and you can kind of see the little cracks, like, ready to go.
Yeah.
It's just so good, the fact that it was all practical. Because Frank Oz, when the Fathom movie events, when they bring out movies again, theaters, we went last month or two to see Little Shop, and he had a foreword before the movie that said, you know, nowadays this movie can never be made because it would all just be CGI. Mm-hmm. It can never be made the way they did it.
Yeah. We were discussing that, too, about Roger Rabbit, that it's just those movies in that decade were so innovative, and they didn't take shortcuts, and they went the long way around, and they are great because of that. Yeah.
The separately drawn Dumbo throughout the blinds, the separation of the blinds. I mean, that's all hand drawn frame by frame. Crazy.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons to love Little Shop. Yeah. The music's good, but then there's so many movies that can compare dramatically and this and that. But when you just put it all together, that's the entire package deal.
Yeah.
And it does become, like you said, it becomes almost a disaster movie or a nod to the classic sci-fi horror movies like The Blob or the Ant or, you know, things like that. And ends with Audrey 2, I think that's Audrey 2, sitting on the top of the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
At least if it's not Audrey 2, it's still Levi Stubbs is laughing and then bursting through the movie screen at what would have been the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Which looked awesome in the theater. I almost didn't go because I have it on Blu-ray and I'm like, it's just like a Blu-ray and a big screen in the theater. But the sound was crazy. I mean, the audio was different than I've ever heard it as far as separation. It coming through the screen at the end looked crazy in the theaters.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's so good.
That's great.
And that's how they do it in the play. So in the play, the plant takes over and they usually go up into the bays or catwalks and will unroll vines as though it's taking over the specific theater you're in. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you mentioned the blob, I mean, there's so many, just the environment, like that New York stoops kind of thing. Where there's one where it busts through a movie marquee and that totally reminds me of when the blob is like pouring out of the building.
Yeah.
And that was a subconscious thing. And as soon as you said it, I was like, that's what's comforting about it. It's just that sci-fi quality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even the way they put the end with the question mark, exclamation point, question mark. Like,
the end?
This is the way movies used to end back then, all those fantastic kind of movies. And if you're curious about all this and you don't have the Blu-rays, you can see all this on YouTube. And I encourage you to.
Indeed. And then look up the split screen shot by shot Family Guy.
Oh, yeah. Somewhere there's green.
Not even one word change except for Chris. He says Chris's name instead, but shot by shot, it's the same. It's so good.
Have I skipped over anything that anyone feels like needs to be mentioned?
I think that this was a very good pacing in order to mentioning the movie, and it was awesome to hear an organized talk about it.
That's why
we have notes. That's why we have notes.
Well, in that case, I believe we're ready for our reviews. And the way we do this on the Gradies is we take out of five our original viewing of the film versus our 2018 viewing. Sorry, of the film.
Come on, give it the times, man. We got Zima and Hula Hoops now.
Zima. So, Christy, what do you think? Little Shop of Horrors, does it hold up?
I have to say, as an obligatory theater nerd, I probably had to give it a 4.5 when I first saw it in pieces. Now I give it a 5. I give it a 5. Easy, hands down.
If I wasn't holding the pepper spray up to your open eye, would you have said that?
Still, yes.
All right, great.
Your pepper spray does not does not influence me, sir.
Dang.
I have my own independent thought, Josh.
My own pimple-popping thoughts.
Well, I'll go next. We'll save Josh for last. He's our guest.
That's life.
In 1986, I instantly fell in love with this. I was a closet musical fan as a 13-year-old boy, and I was mesmerized by it, and I would have given it a 5 out of 5. And in 2018, nothing has changed. I don't do a lot of stuff like, I mean, like you guys are theater people, and I love hanging out with theater people and picking their brain. And I would love to be in something like this one day. I'm not saying even any of the major people. I just want to be a bum on Skid Row. This would be so much fun.
Well, start practicing.
I want one of those prop plants that everyone's carrying around at the end in the store. The little tiny Audrey 2s. Someone has those.
Oh, yeah. And when I like to make lists. We're going to make lists later. When I think of my favorite musicals, I don't know why I never think of this. It doesn't come up. I'm generally thinking of, I don't know, more classic kind of things. And from now on, it must come up because I adore it.
And time for that tattoo.
That's right. Ooh, it was a great choice. And my 2018 ranking is also a 5 out of 5. So, Josh, what do you think? Then versus now.
So then, it's seen in snippets, didn't really know how it was all done, and I didn't unappreciate it, but compared to now, I'd say honestly, like maybe a 3 or something. It just sort of wasn't one of those other movies because we were spoiled in the 80s and had, speaking of Rick Moranis, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and big scale, crazy set movies like that you sort of took for granted. But then when you realize how much work went into it, and more so than that, it's just awesome movie. Of course, the only thing that's changed since back then and now as I have a little extra hair on my knuckles, but nowhere else. And I give the movie a 5. And I'm showing Christy right now that what I just said is true.
Yeah, his knuckles are hairy.
I can't even wave at people without my hand slowing down from the wind drag.
And I don't even want to know where everything else without the hair entails.
Don't ask. Don't. Oh, oh, oh.
Chrissy said I look like a used Swiffer. I don't know what that means.
Christy, has this ever happened before? This is a perfect score.
No, this has not. This
I think
is
you
a
did
perfect...
it with Real Genius, didn't you?
Oh, yes, we did. We did.
I did my research
Real
on this
Real
podcast.
Genius did. So two in a row that have actually held up. 2018 may be the year of the awesome movie.
That's a average of a five. You know, great choice, Josh. I mean, really.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
We'd like to thank all of you for listening to The Gritties. In a few minutes, we're going to continue this discussion, and you'll hear it next week, where we will count up our best five Steve Martin films as a crossover between The Gritties and our list show, The Best of Fives. You can check us out on Facebook, also on Twitter, and any of our other shows that are on NeoZaz.com. NeoZaz is on Instagram, as well as those other things. We have a lot of different 80s movies that we've discussed, and we have a lot of other shows that you may be interested in. Chances are, if there's something in pop culture that you like, we've liked it too, and we've talked about it on a podcast. So thanks again, Josh. It's been a thin slice of heaven.
Thank you. That was my dancer name.
What's Christie's? Pimple popping nubbin.
Great.
PPNB.
It's cold. It's freaking cold here.
And I don't want to hear that it's cold coming from anywhere down there.
Yeah, you are in the...
Where are you?
Outside Philadelphia.
Okay. Yeah, we don't have room to complain. The craziest thing, I just read an article on a side note, the craziest thing we have in Florida right now with the weather is iguanas and lizards getting frozen in the tree and falling because they go into like a coma. They're alive, but they fall. So we have raining lizards right now.
That's hilarious.
She has good notes here. I'm looking over her notes. I assume you've seen Little Shop of Horrors, especially since we're doing the podcast, sir.
She takes notes?
I know.
Yes, I take
it was
notes.
On the top of her head.
I didn't even know she watched the movie.
Are you ready, Dave?
Go back through all my notes. Yeah, I'm always ready, yo.
Do you have notes?
I have several.
She didn't know you did notes.
I thought you said you didn't write shit down.
This is starting with distrust.
That's how they all start. And get me some lunch! Think about a room at the Ritz, wrapped in velvet, covered in clear. A little nookie gonna clean up those zits and you'll get it. She had like a Harley machine, tooling around like I was James Dean. What the hell is that? What the hell is that? How did that dang deal get here? Hey, come over here and look at this deal. What the hell is that?